Presenter in this lightning round, and everybody's staying admirably on time, so we'll have plenty of time for discussion, is Elizabeth Everington. Elizabeth teaches history at Concordia University in St. Paul, Minnesota. She is currently revising her doctoral dissertation that she completed in 2011 at UCLA in the history department. Her research focuses on gender and politics during the Dreyfus Affair, and she's one of the members of our panel who has some real familiarity with material culture, having published a wonderful chapter called René Lalique, The Third Republic in Glass, in a recent catalog on Lalique's work. Today, Elizabeth will be speaking on anti-Semitism à la mode, fashion, politics, and identity at the turn of the century.
So we're moving back in time again. Okay. There we go. Okay, so before getting into the matter of fashion and identity within turn-of-the-century anti-Semitism, I'd like to provide a brief introduction to La Libre Parole, which I'll be talking about today, and the question of anti-Semitic identity. So La Libre Parole was a daily newspaper within the popular political press. It was mid-range in price, so it's somewhere between the true penny press and the more prestige publications like Le Figaro. And it was steeped in polemic, but it wasn't the arm of a particular political grouping or party. So this means that La Libre Parole is absolutely and entirely political without being a party bulletin or newsletter. So it's a daily newspaper. It's just completely political. So like other dailies, it has everything that turn-of-the-century readers would expect in a daily newspaper. It has an editorial column. It has news. It has faits divers. It has various columns, theater, sports, as we'll talk about. It has a fashion column. It has a feuilleton. It has games and riddles. And it has advertisements. However, all of these are more or less anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitic beliefs were very common across the political spectrum in fin de siècle France, particularly after the 1886 publication of La France Juive. Edouard Drumont's wildly popular two-volume compendium of anti-Semitic polemic. However, within, yet distinct from the era's kind of ambient anti-Jewishness, is a growing faction of people and entities for which anti-Semitism functioned as an ideological identity. La Libre Parole, which was founded by Drumont in 1892, was the node around which this political identity grew. As the 1890s progress, there are more anti-Semitic leagues with their own newspapers, but they still tend to be connected in some way to La Libre Parole and Drumont. So what does it mean to be an anti-Semite? A big A, anti-Semite, as opposed to someone who is anti-Semitic. So in his memoir, La Libre Parole's staffer, Raphael Viau, describes realizing he was an anti-Semite after devouring La France Juive over the course of a week, which was a task, because La France Juive is huge. It is about 1,200 pages long. It is incredibly repetitive. Drumont's prose is... Anyway, in Viau's case, this realization entailed moving to Paris, getting hired by the newspaper, and fighting duels and libel suits alike. But for most would-be anti-Semites, particularly for female would-be anti-Semites, this was not really feasible. What they could do, though, was subscribe to La Libre Parole, participate in activities sponsored by the newspaper, and buy the goods that were advertised in it, including works of propaganda, sponsored insurance plans, and items featured in the illustrated ads on the back page. So you see a couple of these advertisements. There is a toothpaste being advertised, and then there are also advertisements for clothing and for department stores and all of that, which is actually rather ironic, as I will get to in a minute. So buying material goods tenuously associated with a political newspaper seems in 2017 to be little more than late 19th century slacktivism. But to thusly dismiss these actions is to misunderstand fin de siècle anti-Semitism and women's political action. Anti-Semitic leagues, newspapers, and groups, as Seema kind of talked about, were obsessed with supposed Jewish economic perfidy. Drumont insisted that everything from banks to department stores were controlled by Jewish interests who sought to despoil the French economy and lay waste to French households, hence the irony of department stores actually advertising in La Libre Parole. Ordinary French men and women, particularly women, could combat these forces by boycotting Jewish businesses and patronizing French ones. This message dovetailed with the identification in this era as of consumption as an acceptable form of female political identity. So you have political groups that are essentially, you know, centered around correct shopping. So this is where La Chronique de la Mode comes in. Debuting just 4 months after the paper's founding and appearing almost every Monday, the column not only entertained female readers with lush description of current fashions, but worked to create a shared identity and sense of purpose for anti-Semitic women. Its author, Camille Rouillet-Fugueron, who wrote under the pseudonym India, in English actually, not and, she was India, described clearly, if indirectly, the characteristics and behavior of anti-Semitic women. Anti-Semitic women dressed simply but elegantly, avoiding bizarre styles and over-ornamentation. They were frugal without being cheap, they were good and attentive mothers, and they were chic, as befitting French women. So this all sounds very generic. It is unlikely you're going to run into a fashion columnist who is like, oh yeah, dress in bad taste. That is totally, that's on point. However, India's advice was not just aesthetic. It was political as well. Everything in La Libre Parole is political. In her first column, she announced that gangrenous Jewish influence had not spared fashion, that all major fashion houses were Jewish-owned, and that the owner's sole goal was to dupe Christian women into buying ludicrous and expensive clothing. She claimed that Jewish designers could never be truly creative and tasteful because the Jew knows only how to imitate, and that not well. However, these Jewish fashion houses, she claimed, were insidious. French women could easily be led astray without guidance and by bad fashion. So to this end, India described and interpreted fashion for her readers so as to teach them taste. She also advertised appropriately French businesses, such as the milliner Giraud, and called upon anti-Semitic women to patronize what she called good French fashion houses. So beyond her denigration of Jewish taste and Jewish business, India repeatedly identified these elegant women she was speaking to as daily readers of La Libre Parole, and therefore as intelligent and perceptive. She made references both to the political nature of the newspaper and to articles that had recently appeared in it, with the presumption that her readers were familiar with their content, that they weren't just skipping to the back to read the fashion column. In 1898, during Émile Zola's trial for libel following the publication of J'accuse, she told her readers that, quote, if one thinks that we feel disposed to speak of fabrics and outfits at this moment, when so many grave and sorrowful things are in the air, one is mistaken. But noblesse oblige, and the reader must be informed all the same. Overall, the identity she sought to create for her anti-Semitic female readers was that of women who were not only tasteful and elegant, but also politically informed and fully committed. India's column worked to embed her readers within La Libre Parole's sphere and within the anti-Semitic movement as a whole. By teaching them taste, she shaped them into specifically French women. By directing them to patronize certain shops, she gave them a task to perform for the benefit of the racial nation. In this respect, her puff pieces were themselves didactic and polemical articles on par with those found on the newspaper's front page. By helping female readers to see and shape themselves through spending habits and taste, India reinforced women's participation and place within this nascent anti-Semitic political identity. So thank you.
Is the idea that the panelists should come up to the front if you want to do that now? We have followed fashion down many lanes and pathways in these presentations today, and I think that it really shows the maturity of the field that we can think about fashion in so many different arenas. And if there's a sort of a central theme that I pull out of this as a collective group of presentations, it's truly the ways in which fashion is never just about clothing. But to use Julie Landweber's paper as a a sort of introduction to this theme, we can't just look at the fashions. We have to look at the coffee, the beverages, the sofas, all of the accoutrement. And I think that approach to the history of fashion actually follows through all of these papers. We have to look at the high. We have to look at the low. We have to look at commodity culture. We have to look at theater. We have to look at journalism and newspapers, as well as the cups and the sofas and all of the accoutrement that go along with this vast system that clothing is just sort of, again, one thread. So I would like to open discussion up to the audience. Questions for the panel as a whole or questions for any of the individual panelists on their research projects?
Microphone, so quick note, it does not project, it's just recorded.
So,
this paper is wonderful and fascinating. Yeah, that's questions, but I guess I'll start Elizabeth. What fashion houses were
Jewish, described as Jewish?
Pretty much all of them. She didn't actually, I haven't run into a whole lot of naming of names. I haven't read all of her columns. So I've, you know, this is kind of the beginning of an expansion. I had focused on her Dreyfus era columns because I work on the Dreyfus affair primarily. I've started to kind of like look back and look at her earlier works. As I said, I haven't run into a whole lot of naming of names. The implication is it's pretty much everyone unless we tell you. It's worth mentioning that, this fashion column was being published in concert with the anti-Semitic newspapers, Le Libre Parole, and then others were publishing lists of Jewish businesses. So they were publishing boycott lists at the same time, which included fashion houses, at the same time that India was saying, okay, don't shop at Jewish fashion houses. So if you're, you know, a female reader of La Libre Parole, you get the directive, don't shop at Jewish fashion houses. You can flip a couple pages forward and say, oh, hey, there's the one I don't shop at now. Eventually, India did start to advertise, too. She started saying, like, oh, go to this. She had this one milliner she was very fond of. So she would say, go to this one, go to this one, go to this one. They're going to give you, you know, they're French, and they're going to give you good advice.
If I could just say something, none of the maisons de haute couture were Jewish.
None of them.
Absolutely none of them.
Right?
And they also had clients that were from outside of France. In fact, that's how they largely supported themselves, with an international clientele. There were French women who shopped there, but a great deal of American women, when they would come to France, they would go to the maisons de haute couture, and also from all over Europe and South America. In South America, but none of them were Jewish.
But I wonder if the tailleur in the atelier of the haute couture would have been Jewish, right? Because there are tailleur and flou, and the tailleur would have been Jewish, and the confection would have been Jewish as well.
It should also be said that the anti-Semitic movement was not particularly interested in... They were interested in alternative facts a lot. So it didn't matter to them that none of the people who ran the Maison de Haute Couture, it didn't matter to them they weren't Jewish. They would say, you know, if somebody actually pressed them on it, they'd say, oh, they had the word that they used was judaisant, you know, you're Judaized, so you're not really French. There was a behavioral element. So anytime they wanted to critique something, they'd be like, oh, it's just Judaized.
The other thing I was going to add, you asked about the seamstresses, and that's a very good question. There were Jewish petites mains, they were called, the petites mains, who were also Jewish, at the Maison de Haute Couture.
Thanks again for your talks. I also have a question for Elizabeth. What you described in the column really echoes a discussion that happens 15-20 years later that I'm quite interested in, the emergence d'un style français, especially in the decorative arts. So I was wondering if in the column she was defining what French taste and French looks in terms of inspiration. Was she mentioning specific patterns or specific colors? Was there a French good taste in fashion?
Yeah, there is. And again, you know, I haven't read enough of it to be able to develop kind of a unified, you know, get into a unified theory of style. But she was, you know, she was sincere. I mean, she was very interested in fashion. She had certain things that she approved of, certain colors she approved of. She really liked blue and green.
La France bleu marine.
Yes. It was also, blue was actually the color of the anti-Semitic movement as well. It was the bleu, was their flower. Mm-hmm. She had styles she didn't like. She really, in the 1892, the directory style was coming back, and she thought this was just terrible, and she would go on about how this was clearly invented by Jewish fashion houses.
But paradox.
So she has this idea. She has an idea in her head of what French style looks like, and so she goes and she says, well, this is what you wear, this is what you wear. But it evolves with fashion. She changes every year. She kind of grows.
It's interesting, because the directoire style is put forward specifically for people like Irib, who could be similar as something proper, vrai style français. So
she says it's not traditional enough for her. She's like, it's a simulacrum of directory style. It's not appropriate because this is not an appropriate era for it to be. She's very interested in kind of the historical relevancy. She's like, the directory was a time when they had moved out of the turbulence of the French Revolution. We are living in turbulent times now, so we really should not be wearing these clothes. So she has this idea that like certain fashions need certain historical moments. Anyway, it's a very interesting body of texts.
Well, and then you can trace it up to the 20th century with Coco Chanel and Paul Irib, who Chanel becomes, the face of, Marianne and anti-Semitism in the, interwar fascism, French fascist, yeah.
So this group of women gave the panel yesterday on fashion, so it was wonderful that you're here.
Just to add to that, maybe also, I was interested in when you mentioned, their comment on the copy as a criticism, and that could also be a comment on the growing ready-made confection yes. trades, which were obviously largely run by Jewish manufacturers like La Maison Veil at the turn of the century.
Yes, although it's interesting because the reader she really is pitching to is not someone who's necessarily going to be shopping at the, at the haute couture, the maison. She is talking to people who are kind of middle class. So, on the one hand, I think there is kind of a resonance with, oh, this is a knockoff, and she actually does say, if you can't afford the good one, and you're going to have to buy a knockoff, buy a good knockoff, spend some more money, and don't buy a real cheap one. Mm. But it's, it's very interesting. Yeah, I think there is an element of that, buy the real stuff, but I know you can't afford the real stuff, so do what you can. Buy the good fake.
I was just going to say, I mentioned briefly about American customers, but you have this association between anti-Semitism and Americans as well. Mm-hmm. And in the novel, I mentioned it starts off with an American fashion artist who's coming to observe the French collection, presumably to go back to the States to reproduce these. So there is this collusion here between Americans and this kind of anti-Semitic discourse. And in the particular novel I read, which, as I said, it's a goldmine of stereotypes, you have an American millionaire who comes to Paris and who will be the lover of Ruby Abramovich. And so it all mixes together.
Right, which would have also been a cultural threat as well, that American influence.
One of the funniest things, since I mentioned Paul Poiret, was he came back from the States, because that's where his market was, with six American models. And there was a real uproar about the fact that he was bringing back American models for his French house. And his explanation was that American women are larger, they're taller than the French, so that he needed American models. And the newspapers were all observing these American models and trying to judge their behavior and were they vulgar or any of this. And they decided that they actually were fairly polite and were not an embarrassment. But again, this is the whole American Jewish thing happening.
Since you're talking about shmatas, I just want to share. A phrase coined by a haberdasher in Dijon and myself in the 1990s. That one who sells shmatas is a shmatalog, and the science of selling shmatas is shmatology. So you can add this to your repertoire for fun.
Okay.
She's trapped here.
Yeah, so again, just to continue this part of the discussion, it sounded, Elizabeth, from what you said, too, that part of a non-French style involved excessive ornamentation, and this would echo other, you know, anti-Semitic stereotypes that you find in people like Max Nordau and Degeneration, and Adolf Loos, ornament as crime, you know, which is about ornament and sort of excess as criminal. So I think maybe some of what you that was sort of a telling remark about sort of excess and anti-classicism and, you know, sort of a style that would be not simple and not classical is sort of in this discourse, in this anti-Semitic discourse, yeah, as well.
No, and ornamentation, she does associate ornamentation with Jewish women. She says, you know, Jewish women wear too much jewelry, too much stuff, you know, you want to pare it down. Although she's not as severe. I mean, I guess she does talk about, you know, jewelry and pins and buttons and things like that. And she says, this is what the style is. She, you know, talks about, there was apparently in 1892, there was a vogue for steel jewelry and steel. And she talks about, well, this is what you want to get. This is how you wear it. And, but yeah, it's don't overdo it. And don't, you know, don't buy the real cheap stuff. Buy the moderately.
And then in terms of the Jewish merchants, there was a Jewish furrier named Grunwald in the Rue de la Paix. I don't know if this furrier is mentioned. And then, of course, the jewelry industry, the diamond industry, you know, the diamond merchants, Usher, there were a lot of Jews in this business as well. And then I wonder about Le Sentier, the kind of garment district in Paris, if there is any allusion to that. So there is kind of a Jewish geography of fashion, while it may not include, I don't think any, as you said, any of the major houses of Wuerth, Pekin, Doucet, and the others were Jewish, but certainly in other related industries, there was a Jewish presence.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And that's something I've got to look for, yeah.
So can I just interject for one minute, Joelle, then we'll come to you. This seems like there's an opportunity here, since we really have this long durée on the panel from the late 17th century, and I want to bring the early modernists in. Thank you. Piggyback on that. So we have this interesting movement from Julie and Julius papers, where there's this sort of like flexible willingness to experiment with Orientalism and hybrid identities that is problematic in certain ways, to be sure, right? But also doesn't have the same kind of edge to it that we see by the late 19th century and early 20th century sort of rise of the expressions of anti-Semitism. So I guess my question for you would be is how do you see collectively as a panel, how do you see the French dialogue with the other, and with the Oriental and with the Jew? How do you see that sort of playing out over this long durée? Do you see particular sort of nodes of change or transformation? Is there some kind of sort of vector? Or is this sort of an ongoing dialogue that French national identity has with the other? So that's really a comment for the early modernists, but also for the entire panel to reflect on this centuries-long dialogue with the other in French national identity.
That's a fabulous set of questions. I was noting a few comments and observations when I was listening to Julia's paper that I think might respond to what you're asking. One was that there was a really curious overlap that just in the same period of the late 17th century and then the first third of the 18th century, where I've described Asian styles taking off, Julia is describing in Asia, where when French people are in Asia, French dress is required, at least in the 17th century. So there's a total split, like a psychological split there. Are you at home? You can experiment. You can play with the other. It's safe. Are you abroad? It's not safe. You've got to affirm constantly and reaffirm your native home identity. And that led me to the next thought, which was your people in the Ottoman Empire and then in Siam seem to be repeatedly encountering or experiencing a tremendous fear that these children are over-assimilating, they're losing their Frenchness, and this is a constant danger, which I've also encountered in France in a diplomatic encounter at the court of Louis XIV, mm-hmm. with actually two encounters, one with an Ottoman envoy, Suleiman Aga, in 1699, and then with the Siamese visitors also in, what was that, 16, I'm blanking.
I think 16, was it 1690?
1683, I don't
yeah,
remember.
Yeah, 1683.
Yeah, okay. So in both cases, the French court, under the command of Louis XIV, said, let's greet these alien visitors as if we ourselves are like them. And then you have a lot of sort of chatter about how shocking this is, and aren't we French, and doesn't French culture matter, and why are we pretending to be Turks, and why are we pretending to be Siamese? It seems like there's a certain fearfulness that French culture and identity isn't very strong in the face of these more powerful other identities.
I don't know if it's necessarily that it's not more strong, or if this is indicative of a lot of the changes that were going on with colonial expansion in general, in terms of that, you know, establishing themselves in North America. This is a fear that they have too, that, you know, the colonists, the habitants, will want to become more Native American than they will French in that same aspect. To me, I'm reading it more as they kind of want to trick both the Siamese and the Ottomans into believing that they think that their cultures are worthy of praise
and
celebration.
That's also going on in France in the 17th
yeah.
century. Like, we can fool them, and then they'll open up to us, and then they'll tell us what they're really thinking.
Exactly. In fact, one of the reasons why they say they want to send children is because children are the least sort of dangerous entities that they can send, that they can have the children learn as much as possible, almost become insider spies, and then they can Frenchify from the inside out, which is so, you know, kind of amazing in that way to think about that. But I think that there's that weird conundrum, you're right, between sort of this celebration of the cultures as well as this sort of othering and making sure that while we're abroad, we're maintaining our French identity. Yeah, they're really struggling with that idea mm-hmm. during that time.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing about the sort of accessories and identifying oneself, and in contrast, and I'm thinking of the German occupiers, when a couple of American women were arrested to be taken to Vitel in the spa town where British and American women were interned, both Sylvia Beach and Sarah Watson, who had been active in World War I in France, put on their pins of the Légion d'honneur, which they'd been given. So they were clearly identifying themselves as French patriots in a way. So I think that slippage between being American and being French was really evident in many situations. And I've encountered a few people writing about their shock. They've been in the south of France, they came back to Paris, and the shock of seeing the yellow star. So I think that we sort of maybe think of it as a seamless event. I mean, obviously it wasn't, but to read people's actual responses to it is, I think, an interesting place to explore more as well.
To just comment on one more thing, I think it's very interesting how in Julie and my times period here, we have this issue of race isn't playing such a big deal, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I have the example of the French kid who gets locked out, and mm-hmm. they don't believe that he's French.
It's actually more about the clothing. It's about the surface appearance.
Anybody
can pass for something else if they're dressed appropriately.
And it's right at that time in the 18th
century. Also, the language, too, right?
Yeah. And it's right at that time in the 18th century where that idea of race is coming under construction, and then by the 19th century, you have this issue of anti-Semitism and everything that's coming to the forefront there, and, you know, even nationality playing a bigger role than even race in that way, which I think is really kind of one of those interesting continuities that we see tracing this fashion idea.
You kind of hit my point. I'm happy you asked, so that's great, so I can pass on.
Thanks. I'm Benjamin Bernard. I have a question for Julia Gossard. I mean, it's a fantastic project. I was really excited to hear about this. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about your use of the term children. Do they say enfants? Do they say jeunes gens?
Right. This is a really, really problematic part, because they only use enfant or jeune really to describe a child, and really this child is a boy anywhere between the ages of 12 and 16. So we might think of that apprenticeship age during that time. But it's clear that they understand them, that they are not, you know, a infant. They are not a schoolboy in that sense, but they also aren't a full adult yet. So they lack that term of sort of adolescent that we use in English, but it's that formation period, and they believe that by sending these boys who are that age, they literally say their brain is a sponge. They can absorb so much more than adults are able to do, and they will kind of become part of this culture much more easily.
Did you use the word éponge? Like, what's the kind of... the second part of my question, I think, taps into this really well, which is, I'm curious if you have thoughts on the kind of religious or intellectual basis by which your actors are this fear of the kind of slippage and corruption into foreign taste and foreign dress, which is obviously very closely linked to morality, mm-hmm. No matter which side of the kind of Jansenist Jesuit,
right? The majority of these kids being sent over in the Ottoman Empire are being sent over by the state, so there's actually no real religious overview that they're having. They live with the Capucines in a monastery that has maybe three friars or priests who are there at the time, and then the rest are military people. So there's no real morality that's going over them. And what's so interesting in Constantinople is that you have multiple men marry Muslim women, and then they defect from the program, and then they're never heard from again, and they're written off as being sort of like missing, and you just know that they had been sort of reprimanded in this way for having these relationships with these Muslim women and everything. And so it's really fascinating there to see that relationship with the religion and the willing that they're, you know, missing. You know, they don't want to talk about that in that sense.
Did they have a grammar school? Did they have back in France?
Yes.
And my third question was going to be about how this affects the relations between genders. So you hit that perfectly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they have both in with the Ottoman boys who are being sent to the Ottoman Empire and then the Siamese Empire. They have in l'École de l'Orient in Paris with the Mission Etrangère, and then they have an École des Jeunes de Langue in Paris for the Ottoman boys. Mm. So we can talk more about this later, yeah. Thank you.
I have a quick question for Julie. Yeah. Were you mentioning Smyrna? Did you mention some quotation? Well, the interesting thing about Smyrna for me, it was considered probably the most multicultural city in all of Europe and the Middle East, and it was well known for the harmony between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. So the idea of hybrid identities would probably be much less shocking in a city like Smyrna than it would be possibly in Constantinople or certainly in France. Mm-hmm. So I think the location there is significant.
Yeah, and Julie, you might know this better than I do, but I feel like that's also one of the only places where the French are allowed in the Ottoman Empire at that time. Yeah.
Well, there were échelles all over the place.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So actually there were little enclaves, but Para Galata, you know, across the Golden Horn from Istanbul or Constantinople, was the biggest community. Smyrna would have been the second biggest. But then they had little teeny groups in, I forget, Alexandria.
Right.
Eventually in Mocha, scattered here and there. But often it might just be a few dozen people. So pretty small.
That particular question reminds me of the perennial tension between youth and age in any history of fashion. And I had a similar question myself about these young men who are sort of turning Turk. And, you know, they're 16 years old, and there's beautiful young women in the community.
Right.
And to what extent they're beginning to go native, in part because of a desire to please, as well as to get out of those silly French uniforms. Other questions? Yes.
Can you briefly mention that when they came back, they tried to keep their clothes?
Yes.
Can you just say a few more words?
I've just been able to trace a few of these men back by the time that they're adults. So they get done with their program around 16, and then they come back. And I've just now started doing that. But I've gotten complaints from their godfathers and from the merchants who they work with that they are refusing to dress in the Parisian style again, which is really causing them problems, which I find so interesting that, you know, you had this problem of not being able to forge these relationships in the Ottoman Empire with those merchants. And then when they come back to Paris, they're scaring off Parisian, you know, buyers in that way by just addressing that. But I find this super interesting, and now I want to look at this more because this should be the time where that experimentation is taking off.
Except that's mostly among a very elite group, right?
Yeah.
And as it trickles down, it's more like little signifiers, you know, like stripes indicate something oriental, or you might have calico, which was forbidden, or chintz or something like that that you weren't supposed to be wearing. And these style à la Turque are so vague. They're so generic in some ways. And a lot of them are also private. So, like, for boys and men, well, I don't know about boys, but men, the most common thing would be a robe à l'Indienne or à l'Arménienne. And those you only wear in privacy,
right?
You don't usually want to wear them in public. So the idea that they're walking around the streets and stuff is odd.
So there would be a class dimension too. These are young apprentice merchants. They're probably not the people who are supposed to be wearing the robe à la Turque, but beyond that, they're also wearing it inappropriately.
The only people who wear this sort of stuff really visibly in public that I've encountered are cafe sellers. I mean, waiters and things and owners, because they're trying to advertise a specific knowledge. I'm Armenian. I know how to serve coffee. Or I'm Syrian
sort of
or something.
Kitschy, like,
a little bit.
I have a question for Julia Landweber about the introduction of coffee and the availability of Asian fashion and Ottoman furniture. What's the sequence of this? And in other words, what's the driver of the confluence of these three things coming together? Is it purveyors of coffee who want to capitalize on certain associations of the clothing and the furniture, or does it work in different directions?
I don't have a great answer for you, but it all seems to kind of coalesce at the same time, kind of independently. So the Dutch East India Company, the English East India Company, and even before them, the Portuguese, had all been trading in the Indian Ocean and bringing back cloth and bringing back porcelain and selling it in their countries and on their markets. And first in Portugal and then in Holland, this stuff was increasingly available. And it was trickling down to, it was becoming more affordable, but it wasn't yet available on the French market because the French hadn't established an East India Company yet. They could only buy it through these other European middlemen, and it cost a fortune. And they were resenting that. So initially, this, I'm talking 1640s to 1660s, these things are very, very rare, costly, valuable. So you have showing off like Louis XIV and his Trianon porcelain. For some magical... So Marseille was conquered. Junko, I think she left. She was here a little bit before. Marseille was brought into the French kingdom in 1660. And it already had... It was the most Mediterranean port in France. It already had an enclave of Armenians, and it had various... It had Turkish and Syrian and Jewish communities of merchants and others who lived and worked there. And I think maybe that's what happened. When Marseille became part of France, these goods suddenly had an entry point, because it really is that year that we start to see everything happening at the same time, including coffee.
So we have, are there any specific questions yet? Yes, you'd like to ask the question.
Yeah. Okay. Paige, I have a question for you. And I find it really important and interesting that you're finding a disconnect between the images of fashion and then the reality. And so I'm wondering if you can talk more about the images and what you think this is saying about Frenchness. I mean, the Zucca images are obviously up for intense debate, but in my own research, I found that Vichy is also very interested in photographs of fashion.
Right.
And then the Germans are interested in making sure these images do not go abroad.
Right.
So I'm kind of trying to figure out what that means.
You know, what's really struck me recently in just Googling images is that the head shaving is the most prominent image. Mm-hmm. Just endless images of the settling scores, etc. And then the sort of reemergence of the German pictures of Paris, which showed you that, well, it wasn't really that bad. People were happy. The women dressed well, etc. Right. So those exist, and there's also a Julia Pirot, who's a Polish woman who's done amazing pictures, mostly in Marseille. And I was, so I don't, you know, and there were, you know, you do see the sort of iconic turbaned woman now, right? And there's an image I had that I didn't, because I stopped showing them, was the woman with the machine gun in her shorts the day of liberation. And I don't know how common that was or not, but it's become iconic. So you think, oh, they were all running around in shorts with their rifles, et cetera. I'm still curious, and from the panel you were on yesterday, who took pictures of the Maquis? Because who the hell would want to have seven men and maybe one woman on film? Were they post-liberation pictures, et cetera? Because that's a whole interesting other image and then of course there are images of women being what are those called? When you're arrested, the picture taken of you, your
mugshot.
Yeah. So that's a whole arena I think that one could go into as well. Yeah. But the answer is I don't really know.
Well, since we have only a few minutes left, I think maybe what an opportunity with so many people here in the audience as well as on the panel who are engaged with the history of fashion to maybe pose a meta question about the history of fashion and French history and French national identity and what your explorations sort of have offered you about new directions or the utility and the promise of using this thread of fashion into thinking about French politics, culture, identity, speculative final question.
Mm, well, we go
about where fashion history and French history intersect today.
So last night I was telling someone about this panel, and they said, "But you work on coffee. Why are you on a fashion panel?" And I said, "Oh my God, let me tell you I've been collecting images of coffee drinking, and it always comes back to fashion." I don't know, meta question about identity and Frenchness and clothing. My fundamental question is, why did the French turn around very rapidly from rejecting coffee as icky and weird and bitter and expensive into something wonderful and exciting and sensuous and then into something French? And I think they did it through coffee. Through fashion. I think fashion was really important to adopting a whole bunch of new ways of behaving. And so you adopt a style of clothing, you think, oh, I look so chic, and now I need something from it to hold. And the cigarette today, right? Something to do. Maybe it was to drink coffee. I don't know, I'm speculating. But I see it all going together.
I would encourage people to take a look at Rebecca Pollitt's book on food and Argentina. That's just something you wouldn't ordinarily look at. It's UNC Press. And she's working on a second one right now. And it seems to me that she covers some of the same kinds of things that you're looking at and has done it in a little bit of a theoretical framework also, since that's her long-term research interest. And the book's already been awarded from UNC Press, and you might find lots of crossovers. And I'm going to do the same thing with Rebecca from your work so that she'll know who you are and be able to look at your work and share some of these ideas.
Are we doing the meta question chronologically?
I think so.
I think you're next.
For me, looking at the history of fashion is something I never thought I would do, to be perfectly honest. And when I got into these records, looking at children talking about themselves, talking about what they did and the descriptions, I started realizing that there was something very important that if I'm talking about children's agency, which is really the central question that I have there, well, their decisions to dress this way demonstrates a immense amount of agency in that.
And consciousness about identity.
Yes. And that identity is something that can and is formed and is often, you know, even if we think about today, it's sometimes counterculture in that way, especially for children in experimenting with their dress, I think is something that they do as part of defining who they are. And so that visual element is something that I never thought I would tap into, and then I realized how powerful it is to understanding exactly how children made these decisions, how they understood also their place within this wider world, especially in this kind of construction of empires at that point in time, and that sort of transnational, you know, hybrid identities like I talk about.
And there might also be something with the coffee adoption and the Asian styles adoption about a French proclamation of cultural superiority, that they can assimilate all these things and yet not only remain French, but make the other things French too.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
On that score, I've been sitting here thinking, well, there's other coffee cultures in Europe, right? But is this, you know, is this intense combination of passions?
Is this just happening in France? You know, I can't imagine the German coffee houses being like this at all. And in Italy, I think of Italy as actually part of Mediterranean culture. So I don't know. I'm just part of the meta question.
I sort of keep blinkers on, and if it's not French, I'm sort of trying to not pay attention to it.
I think this goes to a sort of larger question about, you know, meta, right? about the role of fashion, particularly in France, right? I mean, I guess it's just as much a stereotype of France as the center of particularly fashion and thinking about this sort of outsized role. And I think it's very interesting I think there's so much to pursue with this, and I think that's why it's so exciting to be part of this history, because it is, you know, I think fashion is a motivator. It's not a reflection. It really is a kind of way of moving history along. And I think particularly in France, where fashion, you know, for the women I study, fashion is so central to their lives, and they would never, I can't imagine them, you know, saying, oh, I don't do that. You know what I mean? That's just not done. You know, it's so central to their identity, to the way they think of themselves and how they hold themselves as French.
How far back does that go?
Because I don't know, but that'd be very fascinating to see.
The 20th century stuff and the late 19th century stuff, I totally see it. Oh, okay.
Great.
I don't know if I can carry it back to the 18th century.
Well, so it goes back to Colbert and
oh, yay. Perfect.
Yeah. Fashion in France, it's the second largest industry in France from the 18th century all the way up.
But there's the Colbert economic incentive and motivation. But what I'm thinking of when I ask the question is Joël's invoking this sort of sense of the chic French woman.
Okay, so that goes to the 19th century.
Okay. Yeah.
So the way that after the revolution, it's the age of history, and France begins rewriting its own history, and because of the destruction of artifacts in France, objects become part of the writing of history, and the object of dress becomes part of the writing of French history, and it enters into the historical discourse in the middle of the 19th century. And it remains in the historical discourse. But I just want to. So we're all. Emily and Sophie are French. I work in France, and I don't know if you know this, but there's no French history being done in France today. And that whenever we want to speak French fashion history being done in France today, and whenever we want to speak, we have to come to the U.S. to speak.
That's insane.
Which is it's an interesting turn of events.
Although you are doing French fashion history in France, yes.
Yeah, so
yeah,
we all
are going to revive it.
We all are, but there are no jobs for us.
no departments.
Yeah, but the great irony, of course, is that the British, who have traditionally been sort of posed as the opposite of the French in terms of their fashionability-ness, is the center of fashion history, right? Yeah. For much of the last 50 years, there's a great irony in that, I think.
Yes, because they went at it through social history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if I could just qualify it, the British are known for fashion for men.
Yes.
Standard. We're talking,
right.
We've been all talking about women's fashion.
Right.
And I don't think we should.
Except for the boys.
Except for the boys. No, but I mean tailoring. And Charles Worth was a tailor. He was trained as a tailor. And so he was British. And when he came to France, one of the things he brought with him were the skills of a tailor, which was part of his. Part of his talent. If I could just get back to the question of fashion in France, I think the way I come at it is from the concept of fashionability, which I think is central to French culture and which is built around a model of fashion. In France, certainly in the 19th century, you can be a fashionable writer, you can be a fashionable artist, you can be a fashionable painter, and there is that concept which is based on the structure of fashion and the idea of the commodification of novelty and taste. And so on. And so I see that as the umbrella for French culture and the way its development is perceived, and fashion is the model for that. And as far as the question of the 19th century and the rewriting of history, which I agree with, From the mid-19th century on, I mean, we're talking about not just fashion, but the textile trades, mm-hmm. which are central to the French economy. And Napoleon III was very aware of that, to the extent that he would dictate to his wife, who didn't like them, and he told Worth this, I want you to make her dresses out of silk brocade so that the workers in Lyon will be satisfied. And because your dresses are 30 to 40 meters, require 30 to 40 meters of fabric, if all the women in the court and all the women imitating them start wearing these silk brocade dresses, well, just think how happy the workers in Lyon will be, and we won't have any more riots. So, I mean, there is a political and an economic dimension to the fashion as well.
That goes back to the 18th century.
So there's
the economic importance.
So the fashion permeates all these levels of economy, high culture, because you have every canonical writer in France, literary writer, writing about fashion without apologizing for it. And so it permeates all of this, which is why I see fashionability as the overriding concept there.
Janet Flanner has very interesting articles about the fashion houses as well. I want to say something about the English suits, though, because Drew Tartiere was married to a Frenchman who actually had been killed in North Africa. And she was trying to give clothing to flyers, but she couldn't give them her British suits. The British suits her husband owned. So there's sort of an irony there. Yeah. He had been buying his suits in Britain, so because they had to wear French clothing to look French. Uh-huh. But I, for my work, I mean, one of the things I'm finding that there's a new version of World War II history in France, which is Americans weren't involved. Spanish, you know, and there was a panel, I think, going on today about that Spanish Republicans weren't involved. I mean, I swear, in the Hotel de Ville exhibit 2 years ago, there was one mention of Americans, and the Spanish weren't there at all. I mean, it's shocking. So a part of what I'm trying to do is look at that sort of internationalism that's always existed in Paris. You know, I know there are people complain that Americans mess Paris up, but that's not what I'm going to... But to look at the sort of hybrid identity that the Americans create, because most of them sort of think of themselves as French, and actually the American officials don't like that. They want Americans to be American. But my interest in fashion is really kind of tangential to the... and the American women don't seem to be all that interested in dressing.
You know, you made the American sense just like the French in Siam. Just like who you are.
Well, the noise in the corridor suggests that our time is up, but... In doing fashion history and French history in the age of Trump, this panel has given me the idea that those silk workers from Lyon were really like our American coal miners today. I mean, because from the late 17th century onward, people are invoking those poor silk workers in Lyon and how they're being taken, their jobs are being taken away by the forces of fashion.
But globalization.
Globalization.
Silk does not destroy the planet.
Exactly.
But thank you so much for this very rich set of interventions in French fashion. And thank you as well to a very knowledgeable and lively audience.
And we should also thank Julia for organizing.
Julia was the inspiration.
Thank you to all of you. So in terms of someone...